Of itself there was nothing in this to excite my curiosity, since their errand might have arisen from a similar cause to our own, or been occasioned by a multitude of other reasons. But at least half of these travellers were attired in such peculiar robes as to make it very doubtful to me as to which estate of life they belonged. For some time I tried to solve the problem myself, as to who they were, but all my explanations were unsatisfactory, so at length I referred the question to my companion. "Those are sleepers visiting their friends," he replied. "Is it possible so many are drawn back again?" I asked in amazement. "You mistake me, I did not mean drawn back to earth, as Lizzie was. These are persons still in the body, who during the hours of their sleep have come away from earth to meet with their friends who are with us." "Why, Kushner, is this another surprise to you?" And my companion laughed outright at the blank astonishment written upon my face. "Ah! My brother, Paul was more than right when he said, 'I hath not seen, nor ear heard, neither has it entered into the heart of man to conceive the things which God hath prepared for them that love him.' We can only give you glimpses now of some of the avenues of research which will be successively opened for your study, until you will become overwhelmed by the contemplation of the boundless provision made for our happiness by His infinite love. Let me clearly understand you, Kushner. Do you mean that before a person dies, when the body is taking its customary sleep, between night and morning, the soul has power to come away to rejoin and hold communion with the friends who are dead?" "That is precisely what I wish you to understand. But, I am perfectly prepared for your astonishment," he replied, "but what I tell you is nevertheless a fact. This you would have comprehended more clearly had you been content to have gone home before starting on this tour of inquiry." "Home?" I answered, as another flood of inquiries and associations surged around me at the mention of that single word, for, as he breathed it, it seemed laden with music, peace, and fulfillment of every desire that had ever disturbed me, but I crowded it back for the present that I might learn something more of this new revelation. "How should I have known it then?" "Because there you would have touched the point of recollection, and at that, the whole experiences of your sleep, life would have been restored to you." "But it seems incredible," I replied. "Things are not always what they seem," he said. "Let us speak of this matter a little, and I think you will soon see that the door of possibility is at least standing ajar, if not wide open. To begin with, man is created in the image of God, which of course is in a spiritual rather than a physical sense, for God is spirit. This offshoot of, emanation from, or begotten of God which becomes man then, partakes of the characteristics of its source or origin. 'He that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep,' and the mind is like its God - possesses the inherent quality of continuity of action or operation. On earth the physical body is the organ through which the mind works, but being only capable of a limited amount of labor before weariness ensues, a period of rest and recuperation becomes necessary. The spirit is still willing, it is the flesh that is weak, so night has been ordained to meet the requirements of the body. But there is no night in heaven, simply because the spiritual part of man never wearies, therefore has no need to rest in the sense in which the body demands it. Now, as sleep is a state of unconsciousness impossible to attain in the immortal spirit, it is absolutely necessary that the latter shall be withdrawn in order that the body may secure the former. And since there is no physical restriction in the spirit state, what more natural than that at such times the communion between kindred souls should be resumed? What is the difference, then, between sleep and death? Very little indeed, so far as leaving the body is concerned, but in the case of the sleeper a provision is made for return, by means of a lifeline, a bright electric hair line, very similar to those you saw recently, by which a kind of telephonic communication between soul and body is maintained. So long as this line remains unbroken, the soul has power to return. Once snap it and the sleep becomes death. How can each sleeper make sure of finding the desired friend? There is provision made for that, as for everything else, he replied. Just as there are localities adapted to every possible condition of the soul which has left the body, so there is a sleep state, a boundary, or half-way condition, where these meetings take place. We will visit one of these rendezvous if you wish it." "I should be delighted," I replied. But do all sleepers come here? There is nothing to prevent them doing so if they choose, and I have no doubt but that the great majority of mankind do. Then why is it that no one appears to know anything about it? There are two reasons for this. I will take the one naturally existing first, because it is the one most easily explained. I have already indicated to you the reason why we are invisible to our friends on Earth, and they invisible to us. We each stand outside the gamut of the other's perceptive faculties, and between us lies a gulf only to be spanned by sympathy. This same difficulty exists between the physical brain and its spiritual equivalent, preventing the translation of the memory of the higher into the lower condition. Still, the task is not at all a hopeless one. As I have said, the difficulty is natural, and therefore may be overcome. The sleep state could then be pressed into service as a most important factor in the regeneration of the world. How? By directing rather than repressing the natural tendencies to remember, which are to be found generally in children. If these could only be nurtured, it would be impossible to estimate the advantage in consolation thereby secured by obliterating the idea of death. Let me suppose a case, by no means an uncommon one. An only and much loved child dies when but 2 or 3 years old, but the mourning mother lives on for 20, 30, or perhaps 40 years, her only hope being that she will meet her darling again in heaven. Now, the joy of their reunion will be altogether regulated by their mutual recognition of each other whenever that meeting happens. No intercourse has taken place during the long interval. The mother has continued to think of her baby child, while the angel has but dim recollections of the girl mother she knew in the long ago. But instead of these hopes being gratified, the child beholds a strange woman, with face wrinkled with care, hair silvered, and form weakened and bowed, until she fails to recognize the parent she has waited for. What of the mother? In that woman beautiful in all the soul's expansion, is it possible she has regained her child? No. Indeed, death did rob her, and there would be no power in heaven to make a restoration, if such were the facts of the case. Thank God they are not. Now just let us turn to the realities which exist and learn how much better God is in such cases than men imagine. When the child is brought here, the love lines are attached, with which you have now grown familiar, but in this case there is a counteracting agent brought into action to prevent any undue influence being exercised until such time as the child is able to understand. This is accomplished by the guardian angel of the little one, who now becomes her instructor, nurse if you will, and part of whose duty consists in developing the love which at present maintains between her charge and its mother, for no severance of love is ever permitted to take place on our side. This can only be effected by the sin of the mother placing her out of sympathy with the child. Here it is that the sweet ministry of the sleep state comes in with its continued communion, which can laugh at death, and at least one third of the lives of parent and child are spent in each other's companionship, ignorant as the mother may be of the fact. The child, however, is satisfied, because her love is built up and strengthened, while the earth experiences of the mother becomes valuable object, lessons which the guardian is ever careful to use in the education of her charge. Months pass by, and at length the still aching heart of the mother cries out, "Oh, if I could only see her in a dream, it would comfort me." And she knows not that her prayer is the first vibration of her sleep memory, which all this time has been striving to translate itself into her waking hours. But so it is. The prayer awakens another hope, begotten by some deep found faith in love's unknown mysterious bowers, which feels omnipotent, or death, nor earth, nor hell, restrains its powers. God hears the prayer. He had heard and answered it, when he laid the foundations of the government of life. A few mornings later the mother wakens with a dim recollection that she has seen her child, and is consoled thereby. It was just her own darling. Of course it was, being the memory of one of her first interviews. Now the dreams will become more frequent. The child will grow, the sleeper's memory will become clearer, the communion more intelligent and rational, until, at the time of parting, the kiss will be the usual one with which a child is dismissed to school, given with the perfect consciousness that she will be home again at the appointed time. "Why, Krishna!" I exclaimed, As he paused, "You will wipe away even the remembrance of death if you go on." "If Jesus tried to do so and failed," he replied, "I can never hope to succeed." There are very few of his professed followers who appreciate the fact that he never in any single instance voluntarily used the word in relation to the change of states. "She is not dead, but sleepeth," and they laughed him to scorn, knowing that she was dead. "Our friend, Lazarus, sleepeth. I go that I may awake him out of his sleep." "Death? There is no death. It is swallowed up in victory, since Jesus hath brought life and immortality to light. God is not the God of the dead but of the living." "You said there was a second difficulty in the way of the universal knowledge of this sleep, life," I suggested. "There is a second and unnatural obstacle in the way, and this is much more formidable than the one I have referred to. It is created and maintained by the Church, which could not possibly exist upon its present basis if the sleep, life were recognized. Therefore the natural tendencies I have spoken of as existing in children have to be checked and crushed as wicked superstitions which are the work of the devil. These seeds sown in the young grow up and produce a harvest of bigotry almost insurmountable in the man. This is due to the position which the Church has gradually assumed, that it is finished all that God has promised, and therefore there is no further revelation to be made. This compels the preacher to drop the role of prophet, and assume the position of priest or lawyer. There is no counsel of God to proclaim, he has only a written law to enforce, no need for him to be in advance of his flock, leading like an oriental shepherd. There are no new pastures now into which the sheep can be led. Instead he must play the English part and follow the sheep, who are more under the influence of dogma than of shepherd. The duty of the prophet is to stand upon the tower, watching for both the day, star and the enemy. But when the full day of creed has come, and there is nothing more to expect, what need to occupy the tower any longer? Now, let me apply these illustrations. The modern preacher is fitted for his position by a course of college or university education, in logic, classics, the theology of school, men, and the creed he is to expound. Such is the lawyer. The prophet has always been selected entirely for his power to receive and transmit the new revelation which God declares to the world. "Hear now my words," says God, "if there be a prophet among you, I will make myself known to him in a vision, and will speak unto him in a dream." Here is God's provision for a continual revelation, and the sleep state is the university from which it shall be promulgated. The teachings of Jesus are in perfect harmony with the law of Moses in this matter. "Take no thought how or what ye shall speak, for it shall be given you in that same hour what ye shall speak." And Peter, on the day of Pentecost, urges the same gospel truth: "This is that which was spoken by the prophet Joel, and it shall come to pass in the last days, saith God, I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams, and on my servants and on my handmaidens I will pour out in those days of my spirit, and they shall prophesy." It was in the sleep state where God met Solomon and blessed him with his gift of wisdom. It was in a dream by night that Joseph was warned to flee into Egypt with the infant Christ, and in the same condition was told to get back again, for they who sought the life of the child were dead. What more need I say? The facts are plain. If the doors of the sleep state are thrown open, a wider revelation will be given, which will carry away the creedal institutions of earth, and the vocation of the priest will vanish. But surely you would not counsel men to put faith in the vagaries of every dream? Certainly not, my friend. I think you have forgotten that I hinted at the necessity for encouraging and protecting the natural tendencies to be found in children. Like every other gift of God, this requires most careful development and education before it can become totally reliable in its operation. But how can a distinction be drawn between the true and the false? That is not at all difficult to decide. In the Old Testament, when God first promised a prophet, he very carefully laid down a rule by which the true man should be known from the pretender. "When a prophet speaketh in the name of the Lord, if the thing follow not, nor come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord hath not spoken, but the prophet hath spoken it presumptuously, thou shalt not be afraid of him." Jesus confirms this rule when he says, "By their fruits ye shall know them." Confidence in a prophet would always be regulated by the value of previous utterances, while the standard of trial would always be the cross of Christ. This, however, is not the beginning. First of all, men have satisfactorily to establish the fact of such a revelation, and this must and can be pursued exactly on the same lines as the investigation of any other strange phenomenon in the domain of science. Once obtain an impartial and full inquiry into the evidence already available, and then immortality will be at once removed out of the region of belief and take its place before the world as a scientific demonstration. But in attempting to get this, all the thunders of ecclesiastical anathema are hurled against you, because the establishment of this fact will be a necessary death blow to their systems, and mankind are not yet free enough from superstition even to pursue such an inquiry, which the Church pronounces to be one of the wiles of the devil. What a boundless gospel you open to the vision! This is the gospel, and is it not such a one as we might expect from a God of love? It is the gospel lost in Eden, faintly seen and but dimly comprehended by patriarch and prophet of old. Its day break glories were sung by the angels in peace on earth, goodwill to men. For a moment it shone with noon day glory around the life of Christ, then the shadows of systematic theology began to obscure it, and the twilight has deepened into night, in the darkness of which men could scarcely recognize the Nazarene if they met him. I only tear away the clouds of thousands sects and creeds have conjured up to obscure the sun, and free from prejudice invite you to see what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us, free from any of the limitations devised by man. But now that we have spoken so much of this phase of life, come and see it for yourself. Chapter 15. The City of Compensation. During our conversation we had been walking in a beautiful valley lying between the mists and the slopes upon which I found myself on my arrival. As I did so, listening to the revelations my companion was unfolding for my benefit, many and varied were the thoughts that flashed through my mind. One of these made a deep impression upon me, and deserves a place in this record on account of the influence it exerted. It ran something in this way: on earth, when a felon is torn by the law from home and friends to pay the penalty demanded by his crime, man, with all his faults and unjust ideas, has made a provision for the convict to be visited at stated intervals by his friends, in addition to the correspondence which is allowed. I know the visits are not frequent, and that the correspondence is restricted, but the provision is made, and is it possible that frail, fallible man can be more merciful than God? Can God by any means inspire an act of humanity he himself would be unwilling to perform? Can the creature, under any circumstances, manifest a greater degree of charity than the Creator? The thought quivered in my mind but for an instant. To have given it lodgment would have dishonored the infinite love, but it lingered long enough to accomplish its mission, for as it left it carried away the last shadow of doubt. From that moment I was satisfied that sleep is the trysting place where severed souls may meet again. Some distance to our right lay a beautifully wooded district towards which the great majority of our sleep visitors wended their way. Turning our steps in the same direction, I soon discovered that behind that natural screen lay a more populous center than I had yet met within my new life. There was also something, too, so half familiar about the surroundings as to cause me more than once to look around and assure myself where I was in reality. I knew I had never visited the place before, and yet nothing was strange or unexpected to me, a fact the very opposite of every other experience I had hitherto enjoyed. I stood occasionally to admire lovely nooks and rustic spots with which I seemed to be thoroughly acquainted, or addressed and returned congratulations to passers-by with the readiness of the life long intimacy, yet it was impossible to recall when or where we had met before. Presently, however, I solved the difficulty to my own satisfaction. The whole confusion of mind was due to the multitude of scenes through which I had so hurriedly passed, and the varied subjects which had been crowded through my mind without any possibility of quietly digesting them. This, no doubt, was the cause of the confusion so inextricably jumbling the two lives together yet leaving both equally familiar. Several times I turned to my companion, with a hope that he would help me out of my dilemma, But seeing he was buried in one of his brown studies, I refrained from disturbing him, and walked on in silence. Just before we reached the trees, we turned by mutual impulse away from the more frequented parts into a secluded haunt which somehow, I knew, would lead us to the most picturesque view of the city lying before us. I led the way. There was now no need for a guide, since every step grew more mysteriously familiar to me. Down into the lovely little glen, across the rose-clad bridge which spanned the rivulet, where I must stand a moment to listen to the flute-like music of the sylvan cascade, then up the flower-dressed bank again towards the moss-covered boulder which stood directly in my line of vision. Never mind, it was soon rounded, and there was no need for question then. Standing beside that rock, I touched the point of recollection which Kushner had before referred to. All along that walk the preparation had been going on, and in one flash the clear memory of my sleep, life had been restored to me. Around me lay scenes dear to me from infancy. Oh, what an explanation that one moment made of half the mysteries of my life! How often had I wakened from my sleep with a dull sense of forgetting something, for the loss of which my heart felt heavy, but my memory was powerless to recall it. I had sighed to renew some sweet companionship I had formed in the vagaries of a dream. I felt confident that someone, somewhere, understood my wishes and fostered my foolish whims, but where and who was it? Some unknown influence was always working upon me to do this or go there. My friends looked pitifully upon me, regarding me as the victim of strange fancies from which I had not power to break away. Frequently, when I was visiting the poor, I would come across the face of some sufferer which was quite familiar to me, yet I knew I had not seen it on earth before. Life had abounded in such mysteries, which in my solitude I had tried, in vain, to probe. I knew that in some far away court a man lay ill and starving, but how I was aware of it I could never tell. I was conscious that if I walked along a certain street at a given time I should meet such and such a one, of whose existence I was ignorant apart from my strange fancies. But I would go and meet them. There was no need to tell their stories, I knew them. I simply performed my mission and passed on. A thousand impulses, strange as these, had been the ruin of my life in the estimation of my friends, while their development and indulgence had considerably aroused the pious fears of my family, exercised the professional acumen of several physicians, and been the subject of serious conversations and many prayers of devout clergymen, but all of no avail, the combined effect being to increase rather than diminish the malady. I was accused of lack of natural affection, was not amenable to reason, despised the common sense things of life, and in the anxiety of my friends to protect me from myself it was always a mystery how I escaped the doom of an asylum. Was I happy? No. To ever present difficulties prevented that. The unnecessary suffering and starvation of my fellows, and an insatiable longing for something or someone which I could never define, a craving of the soul I did not know how to gratify, a hungering for some unknown sympathy for which I knew not where to seek. But a great part, perhaps all, of the mystery had at length been solved, the key had been found, and henceforth the enigma of life would be easily read. Was it a tear of gratitude which dimmed my eye as the realization burst upon me? Perhaps it was, for there is one joy at least which can only find an adequate expression in the language of tears. Kushner, my friend, I cried in my ecstasy, I know it all now, but none of the revelations you have made to me can compare with this. Why? Do you mean to say you know this place? Know it? Why, I am truly at home now. My earth life was not real, that was sleep, sleep in which I restlessly dreamed of this. Now I am awake. Yes, I do know it. Henceforth I have to enjoy fullness of life in a condition where solution follows mystery as naturally as fruit comes after flower. Now you can understand all we have been speaking of respecting the dual life. I can, I replied, but how was it I did not remember it even after my death? Because you have been carefully prevented from touching the point of recollection until the most opportune moment. The place seemed to grow strangely familiar to me as we were coming along, I said. I was about to ask you the cause of it several times, only you were thinking. Yes. I did not wish to make any explanations. It was much better for you to learn it as you have done, and now you feel yourself at home, you will be able to dispense with my services. I do not at all like the idea of losing you, I replied. You will not do that, I shall see you by and by. In the meantime you have many friends here you will wish to see, and any of them will be able to make what explanations you desire. He was gone, but I was not alone. How could I be in the midst of scenes every one of which called forth a multitude of experiences that had lain buried unconsciously in my mind until now? Who is able to understand the mind? What undreamt of histories, revelations, and possibilities lie stored away in its vast abyss, into which the intellect can find no light to help it penetrate? Consider but the corridors of memory, and who can estimate what priceless tablets of the past are awaiting our discovery? Are there records of being, of eons, of epochs, reaching back and back until at length every individual soul may read its genealogy and trace each step in its adventurous pilgrimage from God? Who can tell? But who can doubt but that the mind holds secrets which the fickle flesh could never keep, secrets which are too infinite to whisper into the ear of mortality, their weighty import, quivering on the sensorium, the totality of those parts of the mind that receive, process and interpret sensory stimuli, would shatter it, and leave it deaf to every other sound. Earth understand the mind of man. Why, in comparison, it has scarcely yet been able to grasp the idea of its conception. But in the calm hours of sleep, that subtle embryon steals away to paradise, where its generation is continued within the womb of love, until the fullness of its time arrives. Then the soul is called away and in the birth of death inherits the possessions of a larger self, the memory of another life, the knowledge of unexpected powers. How can the full beauty of the plant and flower be seen when the seed has only just been discovered? How can we know the oratorio when the overture has but just commenced? How can we paint the summer when we have only felt the frost? Neither can we who have only watched the flutterings of the wings of mind against the cage of earth, describe the majesty of its soarings in the congenial atmosphere of heaven. My meditations are brought to an abrupt ending by the sound of a well-known voice close behind me, "Hello, Master Fred. So you're here at last."
"Yes, Jemmy, here at last. I got an idea you warned come on this road for a bit. Ain't it beautiful? Has you been up the mountains?"
"I scarcely know where I have been, Jemmy, I have seen so much."
"Did you see anybody you know yet?"
"Not here, but I have only just discovered that I know the place. Kushner never told me, he let me find it out for myself.
Dat's just like him. He keeps on spies on you all the time."
"That's been my experience," I answered, "ever since I arrived." "Number minutes apostrophe, Master Fred, you'll soon see somebody now. We'll soon fin you when I fetch him." As of the embryo, away that dear old friend went to convey the news of my arrival, and left me to recall the pleasant memories of that companionship. I cannot attempt to recount the multitude of incidents which crowded around me in connection with him, but I will mention one lesson he taught me, which, I think, must have exercised an unconscious influence upon me in the lower life. It arose from my expressing surprise that Negroes retained their color in this life. The dear, good fellow replied, that it was all of the goodness of the Lord, that every color, as well as every clime and kindred, should be found in heaven, and then he went on, there were many people who hated niggers and thought they ought not to be treated the same as white folks, they won't go to school or church with them, won't eat with them, or mix with them in any way, but when they got to heaven they would find that niggers were as good in the eyes of the Lord as white folks, and they will have to mix with them then. I shall never forget his glee when he wondered what the white folks will do if they object to climb the golden staircase beside the niggers, for there's a mighty long procession of darkies, and they are going up all the time. Then again, he continued, looking more serious, it would have been mighty hard on the nigger if the Lord had changed his color, for everybody would have laughed at him and said, "I told you so," and that would have made him feel awful sick. But the Lord would not have it so, therefore he left everybody in their natural color until love reigned, and no one thought anything about the tint of another's skin. I thought there was a volume of truth in his simple philosophy, which wiser men would do well to consider.